From KQED and the California Report, this is Capitol Notes, a weekly roundup of California politics from the state capitol in Sacramento.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Hello and welcome to another edition, a special edition, I guess I should call it, of the Capitol Notes podcast from our KQED studios here across from the state capitol. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio, joined in the studio, as always. I think, Anthony, you have a 100% attendance record on the podcast.
Well, I participated once via telephone.
Still 100% attendance.
Well.
Very nice.
Scores will become important later in this podcast.
As we will explain. Nice. Nice tease. Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, and sitting in with us this week, special guest Brian Joseph of the Orange County Register, who's filling in for our friend Kate Fulmar, who's out and about as a pro bono correspondent. So, Brian, thank you for being on this.
Thanks for having me.
There's no money, by the way.
Oh, well, sorry to hear that.
There's no stipend for the podcast at this point.
How about a per diem?
Ooh. Perhaps. Maybe they shouldn't be per diems given what's been going on. Well, let's talk about what's been going on, because obviously we're taping this podcast on a Monday, which is unusual for us. And we didn't tape one on Friday because we kept desperately waiting for something to say definitively about the state budget. And I don't think anything definitively ever happened. If you didn't follow every moment of it, the Assembly passed a state budget late Thursday night, well, early Friday morning, I should say.
July 20th, as we predicted.
Hey, that's right. If you have been listening to the podcast, you'll know Anthony and I said the first day of summer vacation, the 20th of July, we'd get a budget. We were half right.
We were two votes short of being geniuses.
Those two votes being in the state Senate, where this budget is stuck. It's a stalemate. It's an impasse. And they went through the weekend. And Republicans don't seem to want to vote for it, and Democrats say you've got to vote for it or something. Or let's talk a little bit about what happened and what do you make of it, Anthony? What's your thought?
Well, I'm still trying to piece it together. There are so many different narratives and different theories about who was how do we say this on a family radio station? Who was jamming who on, you know, whether Fabian Nunez sold his caucus out and went over on these tax breaks, whether Nunez and Parada had a coordinated good cop, bad cop routine going on, knowing that the tax break, well, I guess we'll get into details in a minute here, but there was a package of tax breaks that passed in the Assembly version of the budget that that died in the Senate because of some drafting errors and a lack of political will by Senate Democrats. So there was a lot of stories going around that Mike Valines was
the Assembly Republican leader
from Fresno?
Clovis, actually.
And, you know, was trying to jam Dick Ackerman, the Republican Senate Republican leader from Irvine area. The Orange County expert.
Irvine, that's correct.
Okay. You know, so some of this was between the houses, some between the parties. And I think there's still not a lot of clarity about how we got to this point and let alone where we go from here.
Yeah, Brian, what did you make of it? It was a long night, Thursday night, Friday morning.
You know, it was a long night, and I think, you know, in hindsight, it still doesn't make any sense to me either. The lawmakers that I've spoken to, at least on the Senate side, you know, view what the Assembly did as being irresponsible and inappropriate. You talk to the Assembly Republicans, and they love what they've done. They think they put together a great package. So it's really hard to make out when you have both the various House dynamics, and then also these sort of internal policy dynamics or party dynamics rather. It's hard to understand who's really coming from where.
And let's talk a little bit about what they did do.
Right,
the budget that passed out of the Assembly largely was a Republican victory when you look at a lot of things, in the sense that it brought the operating deficit for next year down under $1 billion. What, about $700 million was the estimate, I believe?
Right.
Depending on who you believe.
And depending on how real those revenue estimates are.
Well, and that becomes another assumption issue that we can talk about. But it would theoretically bring the operating deficit down to about $700 million. It would largely leave intact a lot of this controversial issue to transfer money out of the public transit accounts into the state's general fund, would largely leave almost all of that intact. I think Democrats got back a couple hundred million dollars, they say.
Yeah.
It suspends or delays, I should say, delays the appropriate term, Cost of living increase for SSI and SSP recipients to help balance the budget. It finagles some money out of the education pot, though theoretically not in a way that hurts education. But long story short, the Republicans dialed back spending under if the numbers truly add up. They dialed back spending somehow in that agreement. And that doesn't seem to be an issue with Democrats right now. What seems to be the issue somewhat is the side deal that was cut in the Assembly. And then conversely, Senate Republicans wonder, did it dial back spending enough?
Well, and the budget that was passed by the Assembly, the budget itself was essentially the Schwarzenegger budget from May. I mean, pretty darn close. Mm-hmm. And then this side deal that you alluded to was a deal on tax credits, not for this budget year, but for the next, for the 08-09 budget year. About $500 million in tax credits for Hollywood movie studios to stop so-called runaway production.
Jet fuel.
Jet fuel. What were some of the others? There was
R&D development was a big one, as well as ship fuel was another one as well.
Right. So those tax credits were, first of all, not in this budget year and also not in the budget bill itself. So the bill passed out in conjunction with the budget.
And not technically a trailer bill.
Right.
I mean, took a majority vote only for those tax credits.
Because it's not for this budget year. Right. And then right after it was passed, or maybe even before it was passed, and I was sleeping as this all went on.
Brian and I were there.
Well, my condolences to you both. That would explain why you guys look the way you do, and I look so fresh. I'm dressed for radio.
Yeah, we can tell. He's got impeccable clothes on. Anyway, yes.
I'm wearing my coffee from lunch. Then Senator Don Parada, the Senate leader, immediately sends out this missive, an open letter to Fabian Nunez, basically saying that he was appalled and dismayed and disgusted by the tax credit package that passed. Now, again, I'm hearing mixed things about whether this was a coordinated, you know, sort of a Louis in Rick's Cafe, shocked to learn that there's gambling in the establishment sort of thing.
Well, Parada's folks very adamantly deny that and were took great pains to tell that to me on Friday. But yes.
But that doesn't stop the conspiracy theories from circulating.
It doesn't stop the chatter in the Capitol, correct?
Plenty of that. And then there were drafting errors with this tax package, which basically it created a... Long story short, it basically mounted to what would have been a tax increase instead of a tax cut because of some technical language. And it died in the Senate. The Senate Republicans, without those tax credits, certainly were not going to pass this budget.
Well, let's talk about one particular issue. Brian, tell me what you think on this, too. Let's just look at the Assembly end of the action from last week. Who won, who lost out of that? Is it hard to say? Let's not talk about the fact that it's stuck in the Senate. I mean, because Anthony's painting a picture here, which I think is a very worthwhile idea to consider, that perhaps it wasn't a great budget for Republicans. I mean, perhaps Democrats did make some interesting maneuvers, like a tax credit bill that doesn't take effect, that has drafting errors that they know probably will get killed in the Senate. I mean,
or it could be undone in the next year's budget.
What did you make of the dynamics of the Assembly?
You know, I think the bigger question is whether you can claim a victory or not. And I think Assembly Republicans can certainly claim a victory. They can point to the fact that they were able to lower that deficit figure lower than what the governor had in May. And I think that they can point to the fact that, you know, we negotiated a tax credit package from the Democrats. Now, you can certainly look at that and say, you know, they're not going to get that, and clearly it's not going to pass now, and that, you know, as the Senate Republicans would say, that they're not getting enough of that deficit down.
Well, then maybe everybody wins in the Assembly. Maybe that's what it is. Everybody gets to claim something. The Assembly Democrats say, we negotiated a budget, we did, you know, we compromised, we did this, we did that. Assembly Republicans say, we got something out of it. And no losers.
And they did it before the break had started.
They tossed that fireball over to the Senate.
And normally that it works the other way around. Normally the Senate is the House that sort of takes care of their business first and throws this again for family radio, we'll say hot potato back to the Assembly and forces the Assembly Republicans to go along with the budget that they might not like. Typically, it's the Assembly Republicans that are thought of as more strident, more conservative. Than the Senate Republicans. Everything, I mean, that dynamic flipped this year, and I think that was part of the calculus. I mean, certainly there were problems and divisions within the parties, but then also animosity and rivalry between the houses is always part of the part of the budget equation.
And let's talk about where Arnold Schwarzenegger's been in all of this, because now as we transition somewhat now in my second part of what I just set up to the Senate, and we're stuck in the Senate where you've got Republicans saying they're not going to vote for the budget as it exists. Democrats say they're not going to negotiate anymore. As a matter of fact, Democrats have told Republicans, come back with a budget of your own. And I think the deadline is maybe Wednesday at the earliest of this week on that. But the governor was somewhat involved, tried to be involved. Anthony, how would you paint this picture? Tried to talk to Republicans in the Senate to get them to go along?
From his public statements, I mean, pretty clearly came out in favor of the budget that was passed in the Assembly. And I think siding with Democrats, pretty astonishingly, I think, siding with Democrats publicly and calling on Senate Republicans to get in line and pass this budget out. I mean, the statements coming from Arnold Schwarzenegger weren't a lot different than the statements coming from Don Parada, which I think is unusual. I mean, I've never seen a budget standoff with quite these dynamics, but certainly to have a governor out in the middle of it and taking sides against his own party is a first for me.
And on Saturday, they were locked in Friday night in the state Senate. Don Parada, the leader of the Senate, said, we're not going anywhere.
Shabbat services on the floor of the Senate. I missed that.
Were there really?
No.
Well, I was gonna turn it to Brian. It's a good show. But Brian was the only one who drew the short straw out of this group of reporters that had to be there on Saturday, right?
And yes, I was there on Saturday.
Was there anything substantive Saturday, or was it sitting around making a show of a lockdown?
Well, you know, Saturday, they got done pretty early. I got in here.
Friday night, then, and Saturday.
Well, Friday night. I mean, there. From what I could tell, there was nothing really substantive going on. I spoke with, our guy, Senate Republican leader Dick Ackerman, several times during the course of that evening, and he was telling me things like, "Oh, you know, we're still talking. We're hoping that things are going to be going forward." But it appeared very clear to me that no discussions were really happening. That there was no moving that ball forward. And in fact, that appeared to have been confirmed in a memo or rather an email that was sent to one of the bloggers from Senator Jim Batten of the Coachella Valley. Saying that, you know, we'd been locked in, I think, at the time when he wrote this email, like 12 hours, and nothing's happening from his perspective. And, you know, he, of course, is one of the longest standing Senate Republicans. So he, I would think, would know. So the perspective I got was that, this was complete political theater and with no real substantive value. I think the only person that got anything out of this potentially was Don Parada, for the simple fact that he got to flex his muscles a little bit.
Well, yeah, Anthony, you were going to say, no. I thought there was a thought coming out of there.
A spit bubble.
Can't see that on radio. Which leads me to this, to trying to figure out, and Anthony said it a moment ago. I mean, this is really an unusual dynamic for a budget. So you've got Senate Republicans who theoretically are talking about a proposed alternative plan that they would submit. I'm not really sure what that'll be, and there are a lot of pitfalls to doing that we could talk about in a moment. But you've got Senate Republicans who are in a bit of a gamble here. And then you've got this issue of whether you can reopen the budget. Now, Senator Parada said he's not going to reopen the budget. But if you reopen the budget, the Assembly has recessed for a month-long summer break and is not scheduled to come back until the end of August. And would they come back early? The Speaker Nunez's spokesman said absolutely not. It's a done deal. It's closed down. They're gone. I mean, I've even heard this from lawmakers out of the country. So, I mean,
probably the speaker.
From Europe, from what I heard. Yeah.
We've all heard that.
In which case, I mean, then it's really problematic to reopen the budget. So what are we negotiating over?
Well, I have heard, I mean, I have seen it. I think I saw it reported somewhere that there's a rule that one house cannot adjourn for more than 10 days without the consent of the other house. So it might be it's a matter of dispute of just how permanent or how long this assembly recess is going to last. But I don't know. Maybe the Senate Republicans can cut some deal that will appease them. That will be, again, maybe take place outside of this budget year, just like the tax credit package that was passed in the Assembly, and something that would be alive and waiting for the Assembly when they get back.
Well, yeah,
I can't think of what that would be that the Speaker and Assembly Democrats would want to vote for. I mean, if there's another tax credit package, a different tax credit package, I can't see, without the leverage of the budget, I can't see Assembly Democrats being terribly eager to pass out a new series of tax cuts.
I have to wonder if the tax package is really that important to the Senate Republicans. I certainly get the impression that they're saying they'd like to see something like that happen, but from all the rhetoric I'm hearing from them and in my discussions with Senator Ackerman, the deficit is really what they're pointing to. Right. The Senate Republicans keep referring to a Senate or a tax package they at one time were talking about that involved businesses showing their investment in California first before they got any sort of credit on the back end. But they, as far as I can tell, are saying that, you know, we're not even interested in that anymore. It's the deficit that we're interested in.
And what's interesting about that, though, is that I have heard the same thing, and Senator Ackerman has said it, and other Republicans have said it. And yet, at the same time, there continue to be these other issues that they bring up. Great example, this notion of projects that are done, construction projects and CEQA reform, where mm-hmm. CEQA is a state law, California Environmental Quality Act. And Republicans are quite unhappy that there are some local communities where there's this now question mark about projects and construction projects and building projects, whether when an environmental impact report is done, you have to take into account global warming issues now with the new global warming law. And they want a modification of the CEQA law in California to say that current projects are largely grandfathered in and don't have to have any kind of global warming impact assessed. Now, that was talked about in the Assembly before the budget passed, and nothing ever came of it. The Democrats weren't going to hear of it, and it didn't become part of the budget. But I've heard Senator Ackerman talking about it again, and it does lead to this question of whether it is truly just the deficit or whether they could be somewhat made happy if they got some of these side issues as well, or in exchange.
And it raises a question of who Senator Ackerman has to negotiate with. I mean, is it with Senator Perotta to get votes out of his house, or is it with the Speaker to get something out of the Assembly? I mean, anything that is – any new deal that's cut in the Senate would also have to clear the Assembly. So I don't know. I mean, I hope Ackerman has the Speaker's phone number in Greece or wherever he is.
How about a third person or group he has to negotiate with, his own Senate Republicans?
That was the point I was just going to make. I mean, I've spoken with the senator about this, but and he of course denies these issues, but – there is a continuing drumbeat of rumors that Senator Ackerman's leadership is in question among the Senate Republicans, and that they want him to be more firm and more hard, and that he is in fact is becoming this tough negotiator in part to appease a very upset caucus.
To hold on for six more months, it does make you wonder.
And you also wonder too, you know, what the end game is. One of the questions that I've talked about with some staffers over there, I know each of you have probably talked about, lawmakers and staffers talked about the same issue, is what is the end game for Senate Republicans? Since they are clearly in the spotlight at this point in the state budget process, everybody else seems to agree on a budget except for them. What's their end game? You know, politics is kind of like chess, I think of sometimes, and you try to think two or three moves ahead. There are some staffers on the Republican side who don't believe that their bosses have thought two or three moves ahead on this one. And what is that ultimate end game here? What do they do?
Cue the crickets. Again, I don't know. I mean, I think that silence sort of tells it all. I can't figure it out. I mean, I couldn't figure out, you know, when I woke up Friday morning and the Assembly had passed this budget that had, you know, there's a certain ideological consistency to what the Republicans are saying on the Senate side. On the Assembly side, you know, they're talking about the deficit and too much spending, and then we wake up to $500 million worth of tax credits, which, you know, I know that the supply-siders say that this will stimulate the economy, but of course, it's a whole other discussion about...
It's a different podcast.
A different podcast, that's right, about, you know, when to have tax credits and when not to. But I can't figure out how the Senate Republicans get out of this and what exactly they want. I mean, I don't know if your conversations with Dick Ackerman have illuminated that question further, Brian, but I can't figure it out.
You know, they portray it as being a very simple issue of simply wanting a lower deficit and addressing some of these CEQA issues and bond implementation language. From their perspective and the perspective that they continually push to me in both public conversations and private conversations is one that, you know, this is a very simple issue that we can resolve with not a lot of difficulty.
Well, do you guys have any sense of how much of this is a carryover from some of the recent dust-up between the governor and Senate Republicans? I mean, how much of them holding out is this perception that Senate Republicans were easy to poach off, easy to roll, you know, may factor into what Brian was talking about with Ackerman's leadership. But, I mean, You think there's any carryover there, or this is something else entirely?
What do you think, Brian?
That's a great question. I wish I knew the answer to it.
Well, and what's interesting is that when we've all thought all year long about this dynamic we've talked about legislative Republicans being unhappy with their Republican governor, I think a lot of us have always thought about it being Assembly Republicans,
exactly,
where the caucus is larger and very obviously a conservative-bent caucus.
Right.
Senate Republicans are smaller, and I think it's kind of hard to categorize them sometimes. And so I think maybe we always thought, you know, the two-vote factor. Well, they only need two votes to pass a budget there. But
Dutton and Maldonado, right? Come on. Come on.
Well, there's been a lot of chatter that Senator Maldonado perhaps has already kind of decided he could vote for the budget. But, you know, that's still only one vote, even if it was true.
And he had abstained. I saw he abstained on the first roll call. Did he stay off all of Friday night?
I do believe so. Yeah. I believe he was off.
Yeah. There was some talk that Dutton was going to vote for it, but he stayed off the first roll call eventually. Voted no.
Yeah, that's another dynamic. But just really quickly, this whole notion, what do you guys make of this whole notion of the Senate Republicans coming back with a budget plan of their own on Wednesday? As I was saying before we did the podcast, sorry, listeners, I mean, that's fraught with a PR political danger almost in a sense, because a few years ago, Senate Republicans were kind of pushed forward into putting out a budget plan when Jim Brulte was the leader of the Senate Republicans. And they put out a plan that had a lot of cuts, a lot of scale backs, and they instantly got whacked by every interest group at the Capitol that said it was horrible and mean-spirited and this and everything else. And so you do put yourself out there with these plans, which this kind of, to me, goes to this dynamic we've had over several weeks of Republicans saying, well, we've offered cuts, but we don't talk about them in public.
Right.
Because once you put them on the table, they become fodder for the entire interest group community.
Well, I think Wednesday could provide some clues as to just how long this is going to go on. I mean, if Assembly Republicans come back with a comprehensive budget plan that has scrapped the existing plan that's been passed by the Assembly, has essentially started from scratch and has some serious and significant differences than the existing budget, then I think we're going to be here a while. If it's something with minor tweaks, then, you know, we might be able to get out of here by the end of the week. But I think that's going to be the most significant thing about what, if any, and I don't know, do you guys have any sense of whether we're actually going to see anything Wednesday? Whether, I mean, Ackerman's held his cards pretty close in terms of, like, as John alluded to, like, the list of cuts and things like that. Mm. I mean, I don't know how this plays out exactly on Wednesday.
It's really hard to say what we're going to see on Wednesday. I mean, I would.
And is it even Wednesday?
Well, I was going to say I would be surprised to see a complete budget package ready by Wednesday. But I guess it wouldn't shock me. It also wouldn't shock me to see absolutely nothing either, or to have the, you know, a session held off and, you know, just do a check-in or some such matter.
I want the John Chung press conference. I want the John Chung press conference.
John Chung, the controller of the state of California.
And the one day of the year that the people pay attention to the controller is the day that the IOUs are issued, typically around August 1st. So.
The controller comes out and says, we can't pay our bills, and we're just going to have to plead very nicely for people to give us more time. And we're rapidly approaching that date, and I think both of you are right. I think that by the end of this week, we're going to have a much better sense as we return to our second podcast this week, I suppose, on Friday. We're going to have a much better sense whether this is a manageable impasse or whether we're going down the road into August somewhere, and then things really do start to get ugly.
Then what happens to term limits?
Well,
another podcast.
Not necessarily. Go ahead and talk about what you mean.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there was a lot of thought that the Assembly, in particular the Speaker, wanted to get a deal done quickly on or around July 20th, in part to ensure that there's not a prolonged stalemate that destroys the image of the legislature as being productive and could potentially hurt this term limits initiative that is on the ballot will be on the ballot in February, which would modify the existing term limits law and allow both Speaker Nunez and Senator Parada to maintain their leadership positions for at least four more years. I think there's been a lot of talk about term limits on this very podcast, about term limits sort of being the elephant in the room and the invisible force that's kind of guiding and motivating a lot of these negotiations. And I think a prolonged stalemate, again, the conventional wisdom, which is often neither conventional nor wise, but the conventional wisdom is that a long standoff would hurt the prospects of term limits in February.
In which case, perhaps, just to fully play this parlor game, that if Republicans did want major modifications to the budget, it would be in the Speaker's best interest to reconvene the Assembly, because the quicker that got done, the quicker this PR black eye for the legislature got out of the public's mind.
Although, as of now, the Speaker doesn't seem terribly eager to do that.
I have to wonder, though, I mean, if the cat's sort of already out of the bag. I mean, you have people sleeping on the Senate floor Friday night. I mean, you can't think of a worse PR nightmare. I think from the perspective of maintaining, you know, the legislature's, you know, prime example of good government. I mean, you have lawmakers sleeping on the Senate floor.
I
mean,
I guess it's relative what good government perception of the legislature is.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, how are you gonna fix that image? I mean, that image is already out there now. I mean, that's already going to play into the term limits debate, you know, when we get closer to February.
When you've got to wonder if there's any polling out there either now or soon to be about how any of this impacts the perception of the legislature.
I'm sure it's being done as we speak.
If only they'll come on the podcast and tell us about it.
I wouldn't bet on that.
I would not bet on it either, knowing the way things go. Well, let's talk about we've been talking about the legislature in terms of its role on the budget. But I did want to get in here briefly. We had planned to do this on the podcast last week, and I think it's a fascinating analysis that our good friend over here, Mr. York, compiled, and his
crack
huge
crack
staff at Capital Weekly compiled this past week of what a legislative scorecard, shall we call it. Describe it.
The idea was to pick 20 bills in each house that have been some key votes to try to get a sense of an ideological ranking of the legislators. You know, we say in the intro to the scorecard that these scorecards, by definition, are imperfect, just for any number of reasons. For one, a lot of the most controversial bills that show this sort of gradation of ideology get killed before they're ever brought to the floor. I mean, we saw the death with dignity or assisted suicide, whatever you want to call it, bill sponsored by Van Nuys Democrat Lloyd Levine and Eureka Democrat Patty Berg. That bill died this year before even getting a floor vote, so we couldn't use that as a scorecard because the only votes it had gotten were in policy committees. But we tried to focus in on 20 key votes and ended up with a ranking system of all 120 legislators.
Depending on whether they were more liberal or more conservative as your rankings go. So we know who the most, according to your scorecard, who the most liberal members of the legislature are, who the most conservative are. So who are the top one or two on each chamber?
Well, again, imperfect, but I don't think anyone would be too surprised to see that there were a number of Assembly Republicans, I believe there were 8, who received a perfect, quote-unquote, perfect conservative score. Among them, let's see, Mike Vallines, the Assembly Republican leader from Clovis, thank you very much. Mimi Walters from Orange County, Sharon Runner from Lancaster, and then, you know, a number of others. I don't know where everybody's from. Joel Anderson, John Benoit, Bob Huff.
We'll give you the address to the website. You can look at it for yourself at the end here. But
and then again, about 12 or 13 pinko lefty commies who got perfect scores on the other end of the spectrum.
Those are Anthony York's own personal opinions and not those of the podcast. On the liberal side of the spectrum, and that would be Lloyd
Hello,
Levine.
Hello, KQED listeners.
That'd be Lloyd Levine, who you referred to before.
Right, Lonnie Hancock from Berkeley. Again, no great surprise. Julia Brownlee from Santa Monica. There are a number of them. Ira Ruskin, a Democrat from San Jose.
Well, what were the surprises then? I mean, what were you surprised about who came out somewhere unexpected in terms of the 120 members of the legislature?
For me, I mean, and again, this is a function, again, of the votes that we selected. But I don't think it was any great surprise that a couple of Democrats from the Central Valley, Kathleen Galgiani and Nicole Parra, were scored as the most conservative members of the Democratic caucus. What was surprising was how much closer they were to Mike Vallines, the Republican leader, than they were to Fabian Nunez, the Speaker. I mean, on these votes, you know, out of a scale of 0 to 100, 100 being the quote unquote most liberal, Galgiani and Parra scored 20, and Nunez received a score of 90. So that was a little bit surprising to me. And then just some other things. I mean, there were a number of legislators who did not vote at all on a number of key bills.
And you would count that as a no vote?
We count that as a no vote unless they had an excused absence. Right. We went through and researched who was excused and who was not, because not voting is a technique often used by legislators who don't want to anger various powerful interests on one side or the other. But they don't want to be on record as voting for something or against something.
So and another Democrat who came out very much in that kind of moderate to somewhat conservative bent is from Brian's neck of the woods, Lou Correa in the state Senate. I mean, which everyone has kind of largely known that anyway. But I mean, that's true to form in this survey as well.
It was fun to look at that. There's been a lot of rumors going around that Senator Correa is being wooed by the Orange County Republican Party to switch parties. And I don't know what the truth is of that, but just to see him look effectively like a Republican in many ways on this chart was quite fascinating to see. Another thing that I wanted to mention about the survey was in looking at the Senate analysis and the Assembly analysis, I found it fascinating that the Senate analysis, the gaps between the Republicans and the Democrats weren't very large. And then there's sort of more it seemed to be like they were meeting a lot more in different places. On the Assembly side, with the exception of the two members he talked about, Galgiani and Parra, you then have a big jump before
much
you get
to – Much more polarized.
You get much more of a numerical jump before you get to the liberal end of things. And I find that fascinating. I don't know what that really says about the two houses, but I do find it interesting that the Senate, the smaller house, would be a lot more contiguous with each other.
And again, this is early in the year, I think one of the things we learned is, you know, a lot of bills – we had to pick separate bills for the Assembly and the Senate because not a lot of bills have had votes in both houses. And I think what we saw in the Assembly, especially this year, a large freshman class, and I think that there was sort of a camaraderie. There's a camaraderie among the freshman class that they didn't want to vote down their fellow freshmen's bills. And so I think a lot of bills were passed out of the Assembly that a lot of people expect to get killed in the Senate. So that might explain some of the lack of gradation on the Assembly side. When we do this again next year at the end of the two-year session, we'll see if those trends change at all.
And what feedback have you gotten from legislators? Because it's funny, I just say this really quickly, that you know we were sitting there with a budget debate going on Thursday night in the Assembly, the day that Anthony's paper, Capital Weekly, goes out to the public. And I saw several lawmakers flipping through, looking where they were, and someone else talking about the scorecard. And you know, there was definitely a hustle and a bustle and a murmur. So
that's
what
the idea?
Back?
Well, the one thing we did hear back was from Assemblyman Ted Gaines, who we a very conservative Republican
from Placer County,
who is very conservative and surprisingly came out as perhaps as the most moderate Republican in our survey. That would be because we mistakenly put him down as voting in favor of gay marriage. I had a very cordial, polite, yet vaguely concerned conversation with Assemblyman Gaines, and our apologies here, first on this podcast, and they will follow in print Thursday on Capital Weekly.
And where does that put him on the scorecard if you change that?
There were actually two votes that we got wrong. So instead of a score of 20, which would put him equal with Galgiani and Parra, he received a score of 10, actually, which puts him sort of in the heart of the conservative caucus.
I'm sure he will be very pleased to see that his space has been reserved properly now.
But he did say that he was hearing about it from legislators, to which my reaction was, hey, at least they're reading Capital Weekly, right?
So. Readers all abound. Right. And Anthony, podcast listeners can see the scorecard if they log on to the website. Is that right?
Yeah, capitalweekly.net. And it's there on our front page.
And we'll put up a link on the Capital Notes site as well, so you can check that out and see what you think of your legislators. Well, I think that'll do it for this. It was going to be a shorter podcast. It's a longer podcast, but the budget is complicated, folks. You just have to sit through it with us. There wasn't time for jokes today, really, either. Our frivolity was gone because
we're too tired.
We're too tired.
I was joking about the lefty pinko commies.
That was about
sort
all
of
you got in.
Sort of.
Anthony has the reputation as the keeping us light person on the podcast. We need that.
The lack of substance. You can say it. I'm the frivolous lack of substance.
I'm sure Assemblyman Gaines didn't say that when he called you.
No.
Well, that'll do it for Anthony York from Capital Weekly. And Brian, thank you very much. Thanks for being here.
I hope I muddled through okay.
You muddled expertly. Brian Joseph from the Orange County Register. And I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio and the California Report. And we'll see you next time.